listening to World Class from the Freeman Spokley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. We are in the 12th year of a global democratic recession. How is America's democracy holding up? And what about the rest of the world? FSI Director Michael McFaul moderates a panel on the state of democracy at Stanford Reunion's Classes Without Quizzes. Panelists include Francis Fukuyama, the Olivier Nomalini Senior Fellow at FSI, and the Mossbacher Director at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law. Anna Nizmarabous, an FSI Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Populisms Project, and Didi Kuo, the Academic Research and Program Manager for the Program on American Democracy and Comparative Perspectives.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome back to all you alumni here. This really is Nerd Nation, that so many people would show up at 9:30 on a Saturday to talk about democracy. So we appreciate your efforts. My name is Michael McFaul. I'm the director of the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. Delighted to have you all here today to talk about the state of democracy at home and abroad. Pretty big, important topic. And we have an all-star panel to talk about that. All fellows over at the Freeman Spogli Institute. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the scope of the problem. So how big a problem is this? Is this different from other times? Causes of the problem. And then prescriptions. Because we at FSI believe not only should we diagnose problems, but actually try to think about how to make the world a better place. So that's where we're going. First question, scope. On the one hand, if you look at some data, our colleague Larry Diamond, actually just speaking on this stage last week for a conference that Frank's Place did, noted that if you look at Freedom House scores, Freedom House tracks the state of democracy in the world, we are now in the 12th year of a democratic recession worldwide. Lots of countries are moving in the wrong direction. You can think of Hungary and Poland. You can think of Turkey. Other countries that went off the rails a while ago, Russia, for instance, are growing in power. And most certainly, the debate about American democracy we're going to get to. And just this week, our president said, NBC News, we should look into their license because of their production of fake news. Full disclosure, I work for NBC News. We were a bit alarmed by that the president of the United States is thinking we should be shut down. I, for some of you who know, work on Russia from time to time. And in the year 2000, I wrote a piece talking about, it was called Indifferent to Democracy. I was being diplomatic back then to Vladimir Putin. That was 17 years ago. And I said in that piece, it looks like they're moving in the wrong direction because he's going after the media. He's saying things just like Donald Trump was saying about the media. And later he did something about that. So on the one hand, it looks pretty bad, but I also want you to think about it in comparative historical perspective. Obviously, it's not like the interwar period. It's not, even 20 or 30 years ago, Soviet communism was spreading all over the world. So how bad is it? How do you diagnose the problem in terms of what is the problem? Didi, let's start with you.
Well, thank you so much for coming here bright and early on a Saturday morning, and welcome back to all of you alum. The scope of the problem is really a question of baselines. In the United States, we still have a functioning liberal democracy. We had a peaceful transition of power in 2016, and we haven't had centralization of authoritarian control that you've seen in a lot of other places. But that said, there are both long-run factors that have been sort of fomenting under the surface for a few decades that affect the ability of our democracy to govern effectively. And there's the sort of singular event of Donald Trump as president that also presents a whole new set of challenges to our democratic polity. So the long-run factors include things like declining cynicism or increasing cynicism and declining trust in a variety of institutions. More and more Americans say that they don't trust any of the three branches of government, nor do they trust traditional bases of authority like the media or universities or corporations. And this kind of dissatisfaction makes it very easy for insurgent candidates to have new messages about how elites don't work for them and how we have to do sort of something else about it, even though what that is sort of remains to be seen. And at the same time, you also have rising polarization. So even though more and more Americans say they don't trust the parties and they identify as independents, among people who do identify with the Republican or the Democratic parties, they show greater levels of antipathy, if not outright hatred, of the other side. Very few of them ever interact with people who think differently than they do. And in Congress, the two parties are much less likely to negotiate on various policy areas than they have been in the past. So you have a combination of congressional gridlock as well as mass polarization that makes governing really hard. And one example of this is Congress hasn't been able to pass many policies since the Obama presidency.
Is that good or bad?
Not great. Congress is supposed to pass policies. And as a result, you have the executive doing more and more things on his own. Obama had a series of, you know, things about the environment or immigration enacted through the executive. Trump is now doing a lot to roll back those policies through executive orders. And then those get challenged in the courts. So you have a lot of devolution of policymaking to branches of government that are not tasked with policymaking in this way. So the effects of those things combined with Trump, who's a totally different kind of candidate. When he was just a candidate, he did things as innocuous as not releasing his tax returns. Fine, there's no law that you have to do that. But he also really started going after the media. He went after judges for being biased. And now that he's president, he's gone after these things with sort of new levels of force, and he's fired the head of our nation's federal law enforcement agency for investigating potential foreign collusion in the election. He hasn't disavowed his business interests, so whenever he travels to his own properties, he does so on a taxpayer dime. He's installed his children into high-level ranking positions in the White House and given them significant discretion over a variety of important policy areas. So the combination of these long-run trends and Trump presents a new set of challenges to rule of law and democracy in the United States, a lot of our norms and conventions, and it sort of remains to be seen what the future holds.
Thanks for getting us off to an uplifting start. Yeah. Anna, do you have any better news?
If you think it's bad in the United States, it's even worse in Europe. Continuing with the theme of, you know, optimism and cheer on a Saturday morning. Unfortunately, Europe is in trouble. There's basically been a wave of populist discontent that's been building up over the last few years. In fact, what we really see is increasing support for populist parties that has more than tripled in the last 20 years or so. And these populist parties basically espouse the idea that the people are not being represented, that their interests are being ignored, and this is the fault of a corrupt elite cartel that basically sits atop of politics and refuses to respond to popular concerns. And, you know, these parties espouse various combinations of welfare chauvinism, of social conservatism, of xenophobia, religious nationalism, and so on. And the outcome has been, we can already see some of the symptoms, right? So Brexit should be seen very much as part of this framework. This was basically sort of populist demagoguery that convinced a lot of people that they would be better outside of the European Union than within it. And a lot of people who voted for Brexit weren't particularly concerned with the EU. They're voting against economic disparities and what they perceived was as an unchecked wave of immigration into their country. We also see another symptom of this sort of populist upsurge in Poland and in Hungary, where these new liberal democracies that had done so well after the collapse of communism in 1989 are now basically being taken apart, right? There are populist leaders in these countries that are basically systematically eroding institution after institution of liberal democracy. They have gone after the courts, they have gone after the media, they're going after NGOs, after churches, and they're basically, you know, now thinking, in the case of Hungary, they've already done this. In the case of Poland, they very much want to rewrite the constitutions to ensure basically their long-term incumbency. And finally, what we see is, you know, this support is widespread. So in France, 40% of the vote in the presidential elections went to populist politicians. In the Netherlands and in Germany, they hold 13% of the vote. It looks like in Austria, the election is being held tomorrow, they'll be the second largest party. And in the Czech Republic, that's very likely to be the next country to fall to sort of a populist party in power. So unfortunately, you know, Europe is not looking very good. I'm not sure where this is. It's not necessarily a crisis that leads to catastrophe, but it's certainly something to be very concerned about.
Frank, how about the rest of the world, or whatever you want to say?
Well, yeah, so I think it's important to link what goes on in the United States to the rest of the world. So if I could channel our colleague Larry Diamond, whom Mike mentioned, and actually Larry will be speaking on this topic to the alums later today.
Okay, so a threefer. Yeah. I saw some of you with us at Encina yesterday. You can do this. And still see Larry Diamond. That's great planning by Stanford Alumni Association.
Well, he has been talking for some time about a democratic recession. So if you look in the aggregate, the number of democracies between 1970 and the mid-2000s expanded very dramatically. You went from about 35 electoral democracies to about 120, depending on how you define democracy. It stalled out in the mid-2000s, and it's been going backwards, not by a huge number, but it's quite a significant stop in the progress. But I think more important than the quantitative measures are qualitative ones in terms of what's been going on. So you have, of course, overtly authoritarian countries like Russia and China, China especially being very self-confident right now. It completely rejects democracy. And so that's a familiar kind of challenge. But what's much more disturbing, I think, to a lot of us is the fact that the challenge is now arising from within countries we thought were secure democracies. So Poland and Hungary are the main cases. I mean, they were the first countries to come out of communism. We thought that they were safe, liberal democracies, and yet they've gone dramatically backwards in the last few years. But I think in a larger sense, what goes on in the United States is also extremely important, because the way that democracy, so unfortunately, a lot of people during the 2000s got this idea that democracy was promoted by the United States by invading other countries, and this was really never the case. You know, the Iraq War, I think, was a kind of unfortunate use of rhetoric to defend a policy that really turned out to be pretty disastrous. The main way that democracy has been promoted in the world is really through the American example, the fact that the United States is an economically and politically very successful country, and I think that continues, that has continued to be the case, but now things are different. I can see this just in the foreign students that come to the United States, like the ones from China, for example. I think 15 years ago they would have said, yeah, we want our country to be, you know, just like you. We want it to be a democracy, whereas today, you know, they don't think they are going back to Beijing saying, yeah, we want this gridlock and partisan warfare and inability to pass a budget every year. This is the kind of society we really hope for in the future. And so I think that these two issues, what happens to democracy in the future, really depends on how it evolves in the United States, in Western Europe, which were the two centers. These were the EU and the United States were the two models of successful democracy. And unless we get our house in better order, I think the global situation is going to be very problematic.
So thank you all. And just so you know, I usually dress like Professor Fukuyama, and I often wear a tie when I'm teaching. But I have a Stanford football game to go to tonight, so I apologize for my informality. But I look more like you than they do. So Frank, you already got into some of the causes, which are external, which are international. But let's dig down a little bit now, right? So we've identified this problem. It sounds like we all think it's serious. It's relatively new, right? The trend lines are this way. In fact, yesterday, Frank, I was talking to some of my fellow student colleagues and some of my students who came to the talk yesterday. And they were all, this is a time you get a little bit nostalgic, right? You think about the past. You should get nostalgic anyway, because Stanford's a pretty awesome place. And they're like, wow, you know, remember when history ended when we were here at Stanford? what happened? Now, you need to read the whole book and not just the article that Frank wrote. But most certainly there was a feeling 20 years ago that democracy was the place that everybody was going. We've now heard that that's not true. The trend lines is somewhere different. Let's dig down now on the causes, though. Frank mentioned the external. Anna, maybe you could start with tell us a little bit about the way you see the causes of the rise of these populist groups and parties that you talked about in Europe, and help us distinguish, you know, the kind of forest from the trees, because it's a hard story.
So I'd say the immediate cause, right, the sort of the most immediate cause of this populist upsurge and the erosion of democracy has really been the failure of mainstream parties, right? So both the center-left and the center-right on one hand, have this consensus about, you know, immigration is a good thing, or we won't deal with it at any rate, right? That economic equality might be rising, but that's okay because it's an increasingly globalized world. And so what happens is there are a lot of sort of resentments, there are a lot of grievances, and there are a lot of concerns that voters have about trade, about immigration, about growing economic disparities, and they're simply not articulated by the mainstream parties. And in that situation, it's the populace who can then credibly say, look, there's this elite cartel. They don't care about you, and we are here to help. We will actually listen to people and attempt to redress these wrongs. And in the European context, there's also the European Union, which has done many wonderful things for these countries, but has never really been able to articulate why it benefits individuals. Why, you know, if I am a Dutch woman, what immediate benefits do I get from being a citizen of the EU as opposed to just being a citizen of the Netherlands? And what's done instead is the recent economic crises have really kind of illustrated that the EU in many ways is a political solution to economic problems, and at best, it's an imperfect solution. And so the sort of growing disparities between North and South in Europe, the sort of the Greek bailout, all of this laid bare these divisions that are sort of papered over. And of course, underlying all of this, right, is both a concern with immigration and the fact that it is changing the face of Europe in ways that many people find very alien and frankly unacceptable, on one hand. And on the other hand, the fact that, you know, after 30 glorious years, the European welfare state is creaking. And so there's an increasing concern with what are we going to do for the, you know, as our populations age, as we have more and more people making claims on these welfare states, and as frankly, we're not seeing the kind of growth that would support them in the long run. And populist parties exploit all of this.
Frank?
Well, I think there's two interrelated factors. So just to build on what Anna was saying about the economic background, if you took a trade theory course back when you were at Stanford, you would have learned that a regime of open, you know, free trade is good for everybody that participates in it. Everybody's aggregate income rises. This has been true. So the global output has quadrupled over the last 40 years. But the trade theory does not say everybody in every country is going to be better off. And what's happened, I think, is low-skilled workers in rich countries have lost employment and income to rising middle classes in places like China, India, Latin America, and so forth. So that's the economic background, but there's also this identity background, because your income and your job is not just about resources, it's also about status. And if you are somebody that believe that you are middle class, you know, you're working in a steel factory or an auto plant in the 1960s, and then you suddenly lose your job, your children are working in a Walmart at half the pay that you got, it's not just the loss of income, but you all of a sudden think, you know, what, where am I in this society? You see a lot of people getting much, much richer than you in Silicon Valley, in on Wall Street. And that's where I think the identity part of it comes in, that you somehow were at the core of American national identity a generation ago, and all of a sudden you're seeing that you're not any longer. And so that's why I think immigration has actually become such a central issue for that populists have been able to exploit, because it gives you someone to blame, it gives you a kind of explanation for why you're not any longer at the at the center of what your nation used to be about.
Didi, America, and talk maybe about some the institutions as well. Not
right, exactly. So
the mix.
So there's, you know, buckets of factors that have affected this rise of populism, especially in the United States. There are economic factors like the decline of manufacturing jobs and offshoring, and the fact that the newest generation, or the youngest generation of millennials, is the first downwardly mobile generation. As income inequality has risen, people are uncertain not only about their own economic futures and retirement, but also that of their children, who may very well be economically worse off than their parents. And then there's, you know, representational political factors, like the fact that elites often represent the needs of the affluent or of narrowly tailored special interests more so than the majority of Americans. You have many policy areas in which majorities say they want something, like a rise in the capital gains tax or sensible gun reform, but parties are unable to meet those demands. And then there are, you know, these bigger questions of citizenship and culture. Who belongs in our society? Who ought to be represented? Hillary Clinton and Trump ran very different campaigns. One was a message of, you know, a lot of different identities that Hillary Clinton would recognize, and Donald Trump very much mobilized like a white base against immigrants, against people of color, et cetera. So finally, in the United States, we have a peculiar set of institutions that can help insurgent candidates, namely the Electoral College, which means that the person with the most votes in 2000 and in 2016 lost the presidency. So you have a weird quirk whereby certain states become much more important, and those voters in those states, to determining who's president than people in other states like California, where we have 37 million people as opposed to like Wyoming. And this pattern is replicated in the House of Representatives, where more in the aggregate, Democrats usually win many more votes, like a million to 1.5 more million votes to the House. Yet Republicans have maintained a 30-plus seat advantage, and the reason is because we draw districts in a way that over-represents rural and suburban areas that elect conservatives, whereas Democrats tend to live in dense cities that aren't represented by as many people. So you have sort of a systematic bias towards conservative parties. I don't mean bias in a bad way, I just mean institutionally and mathematically, you produce these results where proportionally what people prefer, like in terms of the Democrats and the Republicans, is not reflected in our national legislature.
So let's talk a little bit comparatively. Are there countries that are doing better? And if so, I mean, I'm thinking of Germany, but maybe not. Maybe other parts of the world, not just Europe and America. And if they are doing better, why are they doing better? Looking for some hope here, folks. Anybody?
Well, there's...
Can we learn from other countries?
It's a good point. So there's not a general crisis of democracy. So in Latin America, for example, they actually had their populist moment with the rise of Hugo Chavez in the late 1990s in Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and so forth. But that's passing. And so I think actually the terrible experience of Venezuela that was just completely wrecked by Chavismo is a warning to everybody. And, you know, Argentina, you know, for example, is a big country that I think drew a lesson from that. They had their own version of populism, and so they're getting over it, and they've elected a much more reasonable government. In Europe, I mean, Northern Europe actually, it's where the United States was in the 1950s. They're very consensual still, despite the fact of the rise of the AfD in Germany. You know, maybe they're moving away from that, but the big complaint about German political parties up till now was that they agreed on too much, you know, and you didn't have this intense polarization that prevents you from passing a yearly budget and all the stuff that goes on in Washington. Labor management relations, you know, a lot of Northern European countries have this corporatist system where instead of, you know, bitterly trying to decertify unions and this sort of thing, they actually come to these broad agreements about greater labor flexibility and so forth. So, you know, there are some positive examples. Just to take one other part of the world, you know, South Korea had a really big corruption scandal with its last president. They mobilized, civil society got out, and, you know, they changed presidents. And, you know, so democracy is working, you know, pretty well in many parts of the world.
What about variation in Europe, Anna? Do you want to say more about that? Or?
So I think democracy is doing best where we observe two factors, right? Where we observe politicians that are actually willing to criticize each other without polarization, but who are actually willing to offer alternatives. And we also see, you know, and so places like Norway, the Netherlands has done surprisingly well, Sweden, despite sort of, you know, in some issues with integrating the immigrants. Those countries tend to do well because they do have politicians who are now willing to critique and who are actually willing to talk more openly about immigration, about trade inequality, and so on. The other place where we see, you know, in the countries, in Poland and in Hungary, the two countries that have fallen to this liberal populist governments, where we do see hope is in civil society. And that is, you know, there are several moves, for example, made by the Polish government that would have constrained freedoms even further, and civil society poured out into the streets, and the government drew back. And so I think, you know, between politicians who are actually willing to debate and to criticize, and civil societies that are willing to engage and, you know, criticize these governments as well, We see a lot of constraint that's possible on the growth of this illiberal populism.
Maybe also, in America too, right?
In America you have these 50 different experiments happening at the state level. So we can look to the states to see examples of states that are doing pretty well at managing the economy and growing it. California is a prime example, where you have a legislature that works and a lot of effort, at least, to pass policies related to climate change or immigration, all the while managing both social stability and economic growth. And then there are a lot of other states that have experimented with tax cuts of the kind that the Republicans in Washington now want to pass, or with different ways of managing labor, right-to-work laws, which actually weaken unions. And you can at least observe what the economic and political effects of those things are throughout the South and through the Rust Belt, and whether or not those provide a good model nationally. So, you know, the coasts are doing very well in the United States. This is sort of part of the problem. But at least this can provide some kind of template for national politicians to think about federal policies that might mitigate some of these problems.
Great. I want to ask one more question about causes and then prescriptions, and then we're going to open it up, hopefully by 10:15, okay? So I want to go back to the international. Frank, you started with the problems with the big democracies, and first and foremost the United States, and most certainly there's a correlation between the rise of American power and the number of democracies in the world. Whether there's a causal story there we could talk about, but that's happened. Some now say we're moving in the opposite direction and our power vis-a-vis other countries in the world is waning. And some of the countries that are rising, and one in particular I want to talk about, China. Not Russia. You're not Russia. I'm so bored about talking about Russia. If you ask me a question about Russia, we'll talk about it. But, well, I'll work in Russia here. China and Russia. So here's the way I see. Tell us, I'll just actually convey a conversation I had with I won't name him because we're on the record, but somebody we both know from China who talks about their model, and we were discussing this question of inequality and our inability to solve anything because of polarization here in the United States. And he argued, you know, you can say all you want about our system, but we're solving that problem internally. We have the ability to deal with that problem. You democracies, now he was talking about America, but he generalized, you don't have that ability, and that's why the 21st century will be China's century, not liberal democracy. What do you think of that, Frank?
Well,
or anybody, but let's start with Frank.
Yeah, I think that the performance of any given political system can't be judged in just the last 10-year period. So China has clearly been doing quite well. It's correct in certain respects that, you know, in China you got vast inequality, but they're trying to build a social security system, healthcare, education to serve, you know, the poorer half of the population. The problem is that, you know, these systems are brittle. And because there's no formal accountability mechanism like elections, you can have anger and problems build up under the surface that really just do not look visible until the whole thing blows up, you know. And I think that could easily happen in China. You've got, you know, a country that's really got this out of control debt problem right now. Even though the government has a lot of assets, the country as a whole is highly indebted. They've been building, you know, bridges to nowhere all over China in the last few years. And eventually somebody's going to have to, you know, have to pay that cost. What China's not experienced is how people like the continued rule of the Chinese Communist Party in a recession.
Right.
You know, they haven't had a recession since 1978. And that's really the test. You know, when the United States entered the Great Depression, we had an unemployment rate of almost 25%. GDP fell by 20% from 1929 to 1933. Support for the American system really never wavered in that whole period. And that's the real test, I think, of a political system, is not how does it do when things are good, it's how does it do when things are bad. China just hasn't met that test. They will. I mean, believe me, they're gonna face that at a certain point.
Well, let me then ask my other two colleagues about Russia. I'm gonna tell you about Russia, but then you're gonna tell me about the impact both on American democracy and maybe European democracies, which is Russia, I don't think anybody looks, well, that's not true. Never mind. 2 years ago, I would say, I don't think many people look at the Russian political system as a model to be emulated. But actually, Putin's approval ratings around the world are on the rise. If you look at the Pew, what is it called? Pew Center, there's one word in between. But you know, they just did a big survey of 37 countries around the world. And it found that, in fact, Putin and Putinism is rising in popularity. Really, one disturbing part of that poll was that 7 of America's allies actually trust Putin more than they trust the President of the United States to do the right thing in the international system. So that is new. That's a brand new phenomenon. And there are definitely leaders around the world. I'm thinking of Viktor Orban in Hungary, but others of some of the populist parties that you talked about that admire him. And most certainly we have a very prominent politician in the United States right now. He happens to be president, who also admires Putin. So there's something going on there. I shouldn't be so dismissive of that. But I see Russia more, and Putin, not Russia, the Putin regime, as not maybe aspiring an alternative model, but as a rogue anti-democratic force whenever they can be. So Putin doesn't like us. He doesn't like our system. He thinks our system is a threat to him. I've sat this close to him and listened to his theories of IR theory, and that's his view. I think what's new over the last several years, and especially last year with respect to our election, is he's now using methods to, you know, that before were taboo, to really be aggressive about that. I think it starts in Ukraine. Annexation was something we thought was going to be written out of what we did in Europe. He did that. The invasion in Syria and the way that he did that was also something new, and then punctuated last year by the violation of our sovereignty during our election. So he seems to be not afraid to use these methods to break down the liberal democratic order. How is he doing? You know, how effective is it, both short-term, long-term? Maybe first in America and then in Europe, but you guys can talk about whatever you want, right? I keep assigning regions to them. They all know a lot about all of the world. But Didi, what's your take on the Russia threat to democracy?
I guess one thing we haven't talked about yet is the threat of technology, or I guess the new challenge presented by social media and the big platforms like Google and Facebook and Twitter, which control a lot of they provide a platform for a lot of public discourse. And in fact, I think sometimes they think of themselves as a new public forum on which you can have what they hope will be healthy debates about any number of things, including politics. But what's increasingly being revealed is that information is a source of power, and that the decentralization of information in the new technology age makes it very difficult to know what's true and what's not. So there was even an experiment conducted of Stanford undergraduates last year showing them articles that were fake news and articles that were from real newspapers. And Stanford undergraduates performed very poorly. They could not really distinguish between what was real and what was fake, because it is so easy to just create some kind of website. Macedonian teenagers did it in 2016 and fool people who may not have the resources or the ability to understand what's true and what's not. So I think that what we're looking for in the future is for the government to think of ways, the government and corporations together, to think of ways to regulate or at least try to police more who can purchase advertising space on these platforms, what the messages are. If we're going to have campaigns that are conducted according to a broad set of Federal Election Commission rules, then the platforms also have to be regulated in ways that television, radio, print also are. And I think that to the extent that the Russians were able to really infiltrate the information in the 2016 election, that they were very successful in doing so.
And by the way, if you want to learn more about that, we're going to pivot to prescriptions in just a second. Go to CDDRL's website. They just had a major conference on exactly this issue. A lot of it was broadcast, including the keynote speaker who spoke on the stage, Secretary Clinton. And her entire speech was devoted exactly to what Didi just talked about. Anna, what about the Russians in Europe? How much damage are they doing? And then we'll get to what is to be done in a minute.
So, you know, I think Putin has targeted 3 different areas. He's targeted the domestic politics of Europe. He's targeted the European Union, And he's targeted what could be broadly understood as the Western alliance between the United States and Europe. And the country, you know, these alliances turn out to be robust in varying ways, right? So when it comes to domestic politics, it turns out that a lot of Europeans very quickly realized what was going on. And so the Dutch, for example, conducted their elections in March entirely on paper, from start to finish, in an attempt to basically, you know, do away with any kind of electoral manipulation. The Finns have now launched an entire initiative designed to root out, you know, fake news, bot Twitterers, and so on. And so there's a lot of pushback against this on the individual level. On the level of the EU, however, things are already looking a little bit more touchy. So the reason why Ukraine got annexed, and the reason why that is a frozen conflict and will remain a frozen conflict so long as Putin wants it to be, is precisely because Ukraine wanted to join the European Union. And by making it a frozen conflict, it basically can never either join the European Union or NATO. And that's exactly what Putin wanted. And now the question is what the EU does about it. And for a while there, things looked pretty shaky. He was actually quite effective in splitting the EU response to the annexation of Ukraine. And the EU eventually got its act together. It now speaks with a much sort of more united voice. But you know, it showed that this was a moment of some crisis for the European Union. What concerns me the most is the alliance, the sort of broadly understood Western alliance. Because Europe these days no longer trusts the United States to be, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder against Russia and against these kinds of authoritarian incursions into domestic and international politics. There's a widespread worry about, you know, mostly leaders don't say it, but certainly mid-level diplomats and politicians do. There's a profound worry that the United States is no longer a reliable ally because President Trump can no longer be counted on to stand for the kind of ideals of liberal democracy and free elections and unfettered democracy that the Europeans would like them to.
Okay, last question. What is to be done? Что делать на русском языке? Very famous question that Lenin asked all the time. Frank, help
well,
us.
Well, so let me talk about two different areas. So just to follow up on the last two comments, we have at my center, CDDRL, rolled out a couple of big new projects to look at this question of the internet and democracy. And there's a number of responses, but I think it depends on what part of the world you're in, because in Europe, you know, they can still regulate things. And in fact, they may be a little bit too enthusiastic. There's a new German law that criminalizes fake news, which I think is too heavy-handed. Unfortunately, in this country, we can't. We're too polarized. We wouldn't, you know, be able to really, I think, agree on a regulatory regime, although we could do things like forcing Facebook and Google to actually identify the source of foreign, you know, buyers of political advertising or forbid it altogether. But here, I think it's more a question of what the platforms here within, you know, a few miles of this location, what these companies do. It's a big policy problem altogether because they are just, you know, the top five are big. They're basically monopolies, and they would like to pretend that they don't actually play a political role, but they prioritize news. They have algorithms that push certain issues up to the attention of, you know, their literally billions of users, and that's something that, you know, involves a grave responsibility, and they've really not stepped up to it. The other area has to do with identity. Because that's really at the core, I think, of a lot of the populism. And it's something where I think neither of our, in the United States, our political parties have really addressed. And I think it's something the Europeans haven't fully addressed either. In the United States, you know, the Democratic Party has really, in a sense, become the party of identity politics. And it's kind of lost touch with this white working class base that used to be one of the big components of FDR's New Deal coalition, and part of the reason that, you know, a lot of these voters have gravitated over to Trump is, you know, I think because of that, and that is not a good situation because it sparks on the right this, you know, rise of a new white nationalism that we really haven't seen before. And so I think it's incumbent on, you know, politicians to try to create a much more integrative national narrative, not to let patriotism, you know, simply become the province, you know, of one country. In the EU, to tread on Anna's territory, you know, they've got a similar problem. They never created a European sense of identity and solidarity. And then it's manifested in immigration policy. And so, in fact, you know, they've got this internal system, the Schengen system of free movement within Europe, but they don't have secure outer borders, and, you know, that system just doesn't work. And so there's policy changes that could be undertaken if there was a political will on the part of the political elites, and unfortunately, up till now, it hasn't really been forthcoming.
Anna or Didi, do you want to jump in on this?
In our program on American democracy and comparative perspective at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law, before the election of Trump, we wanted to find political reforms that could potentially mitigate, if not solve, I mean, that's probably too big of an ask, but at least mitigate the problems of polarization and inequality. And so some of these things are big structural policy questions, like how to increase education and vocational training so that people who were members of were looking for manufacturing jobs can find other sources of employment. Or you could think of ways to reconfigure social welfare in this new globalized world. How can you protect your most vulnerable citizens? To things that are more prosaic, like congressional reforms, to depoliticize certain policy areas, like budgeting, or to, you know, change how we elect people to Congress so that you could maybe rank order your preferences of candidates instead of selecting one candidate. This might have the effect of moderating a lot of candidates' campaign messages. So there's a variety of reforms that could both solve, you know, the problem of polarization in the short term, and we also try to think about in the long run what can we do to create better opportunities in society and stem the tide of some of these problems.
Anna?
I'd say we need to understand, and I think we need to engage, right? And so, you know, there are a variety of projects here that seek to understand why we do see these global populisms, right? Why is it that populism takes different forms? Under what conditions does it pose the sort of the greatest threat? We need to know why voters plump for these parties, right? Why is it that mainstream elites haven't been able to articulate what they have? And so I think we need to understand the causes of the erosion of democracy much more profoundly than we have on the one hand. On the other hand, as citizens, I think we ought to become more engaged. And you know, what is happening, especially within the political party system in the United States, is an erosion of the parties at the local level. We need to become much more active at the local level. We need to have people that we trust running the parties instead of, you know, top-down parties that basically send down activists to various areas. So I think we need to become more engaged citizens and hold, you know, hold the feet of the politicians to the fire. Have them offer policies that make sense.
Great, and we'll help you keep engaged on the understanding part if you join our website and our email list. One of the things that we are doing under new leadership here with President Mark Tesse-Levine and his vision, which we are embracing at FSI, is that our first and foremost goal is research and to understand things and to test hypotheses. Right next to that, or maybe in front of that, depending on who you are, is to teach. To teach your children, to teach your grandchildren, and to be part of educating. That's, after all, the central thing that we do here at Stanford. But the third thing is something a little bit new, which is that's no longer sufficient, I think. And our own president has said it, and I fully agree with Mark, that we've got to be engaged in these debates in America. And not only in New York and Washington, but in Montana and Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was in Tulsa just a couple months ago. 3,000 people came to talk about these things. So we just don't fly over all of America. We be engaged. And we have to be engaged in the world as well. It's not sufficient just to talk to our own colleagues and our own students. We've got to be engaged. That is the mission of FSI. And you can help us. A, be engaged with us. Sign up. Read. Talk, you know, interact to our work. I learn a lot from that. And be part of this more engaged mission as citizens of America and as citizens of the world. That's how we're going to make, you know, I totally agree with what Anna said about a normative commitment to democracy. And we're going to make it better if we're all engaged in that process. Stanford has a role to play in that, and so do you. Thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spokley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.